Welcome to the Tomorrow Brands podcast, where we explore what it takes to become a brand of tomorrow. I'm your host, Ruth Vitok, Managing Partner at Tomorrow Brands, a consultancy that helps launch the global brands of tomorrow in the UK. Today, I'm joined by Amrit Richmond, founder of US-based insight agency Supermercato and Indie CPG, a community for indie brands. We discuss what to think about if you want to launch in the US and trends on both sides of the pond. Hope you enjoy.
Thanks for coming on. It would be great to hear a bit more about you, Amrit, and your background, what you do, the community that you've built, how you got to where you are now.
Sure. So I've spent the last 8 years unpacking the last couple of decades of consumer goods with a focus on healthy, better for you products. But I also love Oreos and Hot Cheetos at heart and keep up with what the bigger brands are doing, especially partnerships or investments that they make in smaller companies. So look at the industry from a lens of brands that are launching for the first time, not just in the US, but in Europe and other countries as well, for inspiration and potential allies for our friends in other countries. New products, partnerships, retail expansion, large and small. I think an Air One launch, a pop-up grocery launch should be celebrated just as much as a national one, because the time that a brand puts into it, I think they weigh it pretty similar, no matter their size. So I get excited as an industry when we can comment or support these smaller milestones that add up to what these brands are building. And that's a lot of the inspiration for the indie CPG content. Is there's a lot of growth that happens in between trade shows or working up to them that gets a little bit lost. There's so many people in our industry that wake up every day and want to support what these brands are doing. And you should follow and sign up for as many as you can handle. But for me, I get excited about making a brand feel seen or making them feel like someone's out there waiting for them to launch that might be able to connect them to someone else who launched in the same couple months, or a product that plays well with each other. So if that resonates, feel free to reach out on Instagram. As a strategist, I'm looking deeper at these brands, like what are their business models? Who are the founders before they launched these brands that might inspire a partnership or opportunity for them, either from my perspective or someone that's reading my content? Everyone reading is probably interacting with brands in some way, like an agency or an investor or a retailer or someone like you, Ruth, that's looking at them from another country, wondering who might be a good fit to launch in your country. But I think we're all brand builders and strategists at heart, if you care about these types of brands outside of your work. I'm looking at thousands of brands on a weekly basis and figuring out what the patterns are between them. Is it the product attributes? Is it the end customer? Is it something we've never seen before? Or is it just like everything we've seen before? There's still people that tried behind the product. I think I'm pretty kind when it comes to packaging or giving someone a spotlight because they tried and they really want to be here. I think that there's so much that goes into building a brand that even we don't see. So I think it's pretty brave what these brands are doing, is what I'm trying to say. And I'm lucky to be their friend or their customer and whatnot. But again, going back to the data, I get really excited when someone presents a product that we're familiar with. Like the foundation, it's very low education, but then the flavor is a twist. Like if someone blended hot honey and protein, that could be interesting. To me, I saw Tillamook cheese and Mike's Hot Honey just did a collaboration, so maybe that's top of mind. I think in any country, to break through the noise of all the other brands in the market, that combination of low education, meaning people know exactly what it is, or at least like how to eat it or how to use it, but it's an exciting new flavor or format or function, has a much higher chance than something where on the surface people don't even know what to do with it.
Yeah, if you're going to launch a product like that, you're going to have to spend a lot on explaining to people what it is and why and how, which is fine if you've got deep pockets.
And patience. So it's totally possible to create a category, and many people have done it, but it certainly won't happen overnight. I think if you have a trustworthy figure, person, whatever, behind it, or a trustworthy ingredient, some type of platform that people can at least understand, it makes it easier. But to people from the ground up creating a category, you've got to have patience. And if you don't have the budget, you have to be creative.
Yeah.
So they probably came from an agency background, or they just operate very comfortably with a blank canvas, and more power to you.
Yeah. So with that in mind, should we chat about some of the brands and categories that we've seen coming out recently that we like?
You first.
Me first. Okay. Well, a brand that springs to mind, which I don't think the UK is ready for, because I feel like it's not become a thing here yet. But I met the founder when we were over at Expo, and you did too, Isabel from Laurel's Coffee.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Lovely.
She's lovely. We get her investor updates, and I love the story that she's telling and how she's telling it. They are really engaging. She comes across very smart, like kind of ideal founder. And her products, right, you're going to have to correct me if I'm wrong here. Is it A2 Dairy? Not A1, A2 Dairy.
A2.
Mm-hmm. A2 Dairy ready to drink coffee lattes, which are really good. And with A2 Dairy, I only knew this because she told me at Expo, it's not the milk that's processed, it's the cows that are different. So they're a different, they have a different genetic code, which means that the milk they produce is less inflammatory. So if you're lactose intolerant, not fully allergic, but just if dairy doesn't agree with you, A2 Dairy can be okay. And that to me, I mean, I might have got the science of that wrong. So if Isabella listens to this, I have to apologize. But that to me is genuinely really interesting and exciting. And there's a bit of an education job to be done there. But I think that in the US, along with grass-fed and regenerative, these sorts of things are coming to the forefront more. And she's got ready-to-drink lattes at the moment, but you could see how that could spin out into butter and other dairy products as well.
Yes. And I like on her cans that she says that this is gut-friendly or tummy-friendly. So even if you don't know what A2 means, it can resonate with somebody who maybe they get a stomach ache from high acidic coffee or dairy. So she's doing the education right on the front of the can for people that aren't familiar with A2 yet. And the format, it's a latte or a matcha, and people know what that is too. So again, it's taking something very familiar, presenting it in a way that maybe people haven't experienced it before, or they haven't been able to enjoy it in a long time. I feel that way about a lot of the functional nostalgia candy and cereals. Maybe it's something that people haven't eaten in 2 decades and they can fall in love with that flavor or texture again.
It's also, if you can tick a couple of trends as a brand, so if you can kind of be at the intersection of multi, if you're on one trend, that's great. If you can be a couple, then that's even better. So, you know, like a kind of gut health claim plus something around this sort of regenerative, you know, kind of agricultural claim. I just made that up as a whole bucket of claims, but do you know what I mean? You've definitely seen, I saw a lot more of those building over the last couple of years I've been at Expo.
Yeah, it gets tough on the packaging because you can't have so many icons and you can't be everything to everybody unless you're water. I've seen this happen with a lot of the keto heavy brands in the last year or two. I joke that keto spun off into a solo artist and now going back to the high protein claim. But it's smart because at its core, a lot of people can enjoy keto products, but maybe they were intimidated by the diet or they're not on it anymore. So there's no reason for that product to not exist anymore. They just have to pivot a little bit to make sure that they're appealing to more people on that diet.
Paleo is another one that's similar, isn't it? It was a claim that it was a sort of trend a few years ago, but actually the kind of core of paleo being what, like grain-free, higher protein, like those things haven't changed. People don't call it paleo anymore.
And grain-free on packaging has exploded over the last year or two. So that's another great example of you can still have the same exact product, but just making sure you're speaking to people beyond that core
interestingly,
diet.
Grain-free, not a thing here.
Really?
Yeah. So I wonder if it's like some, it's really interesting with trends in the US and the UK because some follow and some don't. And it's be interesting to see if that one jumps.
So other trends that we're excited about, I think with everyone being on a tighter grocery budget, condiments could have a big year again, kind of the way that they did in 2020. So even if it's a premium condiment, that can feel like a treat to somebody if they're spending less on takeout or they're spending less at restaurants, but they buy a $10 to $20 condiment that they can use multiple times. It brings them joy.
You're talking to me.
Right?
I'm laughing at myself because I remember when I was younger, my dad would go to America on a work trip and I'd get him to bring me back like bags of Abercrombie and Fitch clothes. I mean, this is when I was a teenager. And now when I go to America on a work trip, I bring back bags of condiments. And I'm not even joking. I think I spent like $100 in Whole Foods and everyone on condiments. But do you know what? I think the cost per use, like you say, over time, you know, if you're using a small amount of a $10 bottle, you're using it.
Yeah, it could be a quarter per dabble of it. And it truly does bring joy. It also makes your home cooked meal or leftovers more exciting. So when brands are looking ahead for the year, I would make more content about cooking at home. And you can have the romanticized dinner party content on Instagram or TikTok, but I would love to see like more freezer meal recipes, more like how to just get dinner on the table. I would love to see more brands launch like TV dinners or easy sides in the frozen aisle. We have a lot of pizza innovation. We have a lot of appetizer snack innovation, but not a lot on having three or four dinners at a time in your family's freezer, the way that we did 50, 60 years ago when freezers were kind of the it gadget in the kitchen.
What is your favorite condiment at the moment?
Condiment. Oh, gosh. Don't make me choose.
I'll tell you what mine is while you pull up one of your lists. Well, this week, because it rotates, but this week I really like the Fly By Jing, the purple one, which I think is, it's not their core one.
Yeah.
Is it like Zong? Mm-hmm. That's it. Zong. Oh, delicious.
Hemp seed topper called Plant Chi. And she makes an umami one that has seaweed in it. And last week I was cooking with a friend and we put it on noodles. We put it on olive oil, ice cream. What else did we put it on? Salads, like just and anything that needs a tiny nutritional boost, but also flavor. So that's not a sauce. That's more of a sprinkle. Actually, one of my favorite condiments right now is what you brought me from London. From our friend at Gret Salad Dressings, the miso vinaigrette is divine. Also been putting that on anything I can. And I finally opened a new tamari brand called Jozo, and they're barrel aging it in a style that restaurants do. So it's literally a flavor bomb, very salty, very versatile. So a product like that, where it can inspire someone to cook from scratch or dress up leftovers, I think has a lot of potential this year for home chefs, and cooking at home for some people might feel like they're defeated because they can't afford to go out. But I think there's so much joy in it if you're somebody who likes to kind of roam around the grocery store and dream up what you're going to cook. For brands, if you can create content that makes people feel kind of less ashamed of being on a grocery budget, that can empower them.
I like your idea for sort of more upscale or healthier frozen dinners as well. We've got a few brands here.
I've been seeing this UK brand called Stocked also. There's these blocks of soups and stews and things. And I think something like that would do really well in the US. Are DIYing that now, but not everybody has time to stock their freezer with meals, like from scratch meals. So things like this are really smart and they kind of meet people halfway. You don't have to cook the entire meal from scratch. You could have fresh veg and a chicken and this.
I also want to talk to you about olive oil because we kind of mentioned it before this episode. There's a really lovely brand here called Citizens of Soil, and their tagline is turning a commodity into a community. So I think there's something interesting going on now around commodities and a lot more awareness of commodities. I think even obviously working in food and drink, we know about coffee prices and cocoa prices and the impact that's having on the industry. But I think that's now filtering down to consumers as well, and the impacts of climate change on the quality of commodities, essentially. And they work with small farms, and you know where it's come from, because obviously also with olive oil there's problems around traceability and quality and things not being what they say they are. So that's a business that I love, and I know that Graza has done an amazing job in the US in the olive oil space as well.
Yes, and they're sourced from Spain, but they've focused more on the experience and community and quality of the product than where it's grown if you look at their homepage.
That was another thing I brought back from the US, was their new frizzle spray. I love that they're talking about focusing on how it's used. They've got their sizzle, their brizzle, and they've just launched frizzle, even in just the naming.
And the form factor of the bottles, I think, ties really well into the trend of giving people confidence in the kitchen, getting them excited to just cook, feel like a chef. The bottles were inspired by restaurant kitchens. So that makes sense. I know we also wanted to talk about what it's like to launch in the US from another country. And I always think about it like your second launch. Like if you launch for the first time in another country and then you want to come to America, it is very starting from day one again.
Yes. I think actually for a UK brand, it's like day 1.2, isn't, in the sense that it's a whole different world in a lot of ways. You can't just replicate the same playbook.
But one would hope that the brand has built up a bit of awareness or community here. Reach out to media in the US. Anybody who is a community builder in CPG, let us know that you exist several months, even a couple of years before you want to launch here, so that you might be able to meet other brands to partner with. You could see what retailers, brands in their first or second year launch in here, because those are probably going to be good partners for you. But if you are a massive success in another country and you have the Shopify analytics to prove that people in the US have been requesting your product or maybe even ordered it from other countries, you have a higher chance of going direct into a larger retailer here. We've seen Grounded have a lot of success, the plant-based milkshakes coming to the US, and they were launching in Whole Foods within the last 6 months. So I think it depends on the brand and it depends on the category. There's not infinite shelf space, unfortunately. For you to launch on a shelf here, it means somebody has to be taken off the shelf, studying the aisle that you want to enter and understanding how long those brands have been in business and kind of what their market position is, I think is really important before launching in another country. But I think the most underrated thing when launching in another country is alliances with other brands and just people in the industry, because you can tap into another brand's audience way faster than a Facebook ad would get you conversions.
So build those relationships, join those communities.
Yeah, and there's so much value that you could offer the other brand, even if you're smaller, coming from another country. Brands always benefit from having more creatives around the table, I think, in any partnership. Don't undervalue the assets that your brand has. If somebody on your team or your extended agency teams could do the photos or videos for a partnership. So it's not just about who has the most followers in a partnership.
Thinking of brands that might be thinking about launching in the US, are there any categories that you would say, yeah, there's some potential here, and any categories that you would say, like, absolutely don't bother, like maybe gut health sodas?
I would say the condiments, because the nature of condiments is kind of traveling through your kitchen or culinary escapism. When I walk down that aisle at Whole Foods, I expect to see a passport stamp of condiments. I don't want to just see the ketchup and mustard and mayo. But that's a unique aisle where it's probably more welcoming to international innovation than any other aisle. Aisles that are hard to crack into in the US, I would say the breakfast and cereal aisle. I noticed that the brands, there are fewer brands in that aisle and they have a lot more facings. So it doesn't mean that you can't crack into it. I just think it's easier to convince somebody to add a sauce into their rotation than it is to switch their cereal.
Interesting. And then you did this lovely little pamphlet for Expo, and in it you had, because I think we get distracted in CPG by all the new and the shiny and the startups and like the exciting brands, but actually there's a lot of brands that are these heritage brands that have been around, they're still independent, they've been around a really long time, they're everyday staples now, there's less hype around them, but they're just these sort of very successful businesses that are quietly kind of going about their business. And we all love a big acquisition. And there's been one recently, and we were just talking about how that can kind of breathe a lot of like life and energy into the industry. But actually, yeah, it's hard to acknowledge those like quietly independent big brands.
Yeah, the zine that we made with Moxie Souza, on one side of it, it's the oldest living indie brands at Expo. I said, I think the oldest one was King Arthur from the 1700s. Still independent. And Bob's Red Mill and a few others, either family owned or they have become employee owned. And I think that holds them accountable to not grow for the wrong reasons and kind of grow together. A lot of them are also commodities, respectfully. Like they're like their oats and flour, very low education products that we just use every day, but they're committed to a clean supply chain or taking care of their people across the company and customers. But I would bet that a lot of people buy those products because they're just very high quality, not so much because of the values. Unfortunately, I think with the way grocery prices are, there are a lot of people who want to care and who have cared in the past about where their food comes from that just don't have that luxury right now. And we, as an industry of somewhat premium products, need to think about that more than we're talking about it.
I love the brand Bob's Red Mill. I keep seeing it everywhere now. They're in Whole Foods in the UK. It's just a really cozy brand, and I bet that people trust it. And again, like you say, it's clean label and they have these sort of staples, but they're just, yeah, it just feels very trustworthy. I can see why people like it. It's interesting because we have the same pressures here in terms of cost of living crisis, as it's been called. Inflation went crazy a couple of years ago, so food prices going up, and at the same time a lot more increasing awareness about processed food and chemicals in food and people wanting cleaner, more wholesome things again. Conflict between those two things happening at the same time, to your point. Okay. That's what people want, and there's demand for it, but whether it's affordable.
So if you're thinking about your second or third product line, maybe it's a lower price point than your core one, not because you're diluting ingredients, you're stripping the soul of your brand, but there's just fewer ingredients, or it's where you're sourcing them, maybe you can get better prices. I don't know. But I think there's still a lot of people out there that want to eat this way. They just can't with current prices. It takes many months and even a year for prices to go down. It's not something that's going to be fixed in a month. We talk a lot about the cultural hook and why somebody would get influenced to buy a product. But what about just the excitement or delight hook of it right now, because we're all thinking about all these other things outside of work and just making sure that we're taking care of our friends and family and ourselves. But I think the excitement of a new product can be an underrated experience too. I got a package from a brand called Spicy Boys that my friend Grace Bryan helped develop. Grace has a innovation agency called Juicy Brick in the UK. And it's this big green bottle. It's almost like the size of a water bottle. And there's not much instruction on it, which I kind of like. So it kind of feels like a tube of paint. And it's super fun to use because it lets me be myself, but also the packaging gets you excited too. It's not overcomplicated and whatnot, but it's kind of like playing with your food for adults.
What is it?
It's a sauce.
It's a sauce. All right.
I think people would have fun with this in the US. And the founders reached out to me, not knowing that I was friends with Grace, and just introduced himself. And he said, hey, can I send you some sauce? And I was like, are you sure? It's a long way. And he's like, yeah, I want you to try it out. And let's just be friends. And that alone was delightful. But I think that's the way you build bridges across countries, is you just send the email. You just put yourself out there.
I love that two brands that you've mentioned have been British brands.
Yeah, I have been eating a lot of British brands. Thanks to you also for bringing me so many at Expo West.
Got your little care package. I'm just going to ask you a couple more questions. What US brands are you most excited about at the moment?
I'm really into this trend that I call subliminal supplements. So products that have a kind of a hidden benefit versus like an in-your-face benefit. So Harkin candy bars, anybody I give them to, they just disappear. They're low sugar, they have added fiber, but she doesn't market it as a fiber snack bar. So it's kind of like come for the candy, stay for the fiber. Flora bars also, I just tried those from the founder of Genie's Ice Cream. They're absolutely delicious. It's a soft fruit bar that has a lot of fiber as well. But neither of those feel like a vitamin or a supplement in the mundane daily way. And way more enjoyable than taking a pill.
Last question, let me ask everyone. What do you think makes a brand of tomorrow?
A brand of tomorrow doesn't wait until they have sales to build a community.
Nice.
When you do that, you de-risk yourself. You de-risk your brand to yourself, is what I'm trying to say, but you also de-risk it to a lot of other people. If you look at what Good Girl Snacks has done, they started posting on TikTok before their launch, and it's allowed them to have an owned audience that most people don't have from day one. So going beyond a waiting list, what can you do to get in front of people most likely to buy your products? It's great if you can get in front of the industry before you launch, but the industry is not your customer. You need millions of people to buy your product that don't go to Expo West and aren't in our space. So spending time where your target customer is, and then getting as many of those email addresses as possible or followers online, I think sets a brand up for success, no matter how the economy is doing.
That's so, the power of community again.
Yeah, and community can mean a lot of different things. It doesn't always have to be a chat room. It can be making people feel seen and heard. It can be the connection that your brand has to that person. There are a lot of products that people feel eternally loyal to that they would never tell their friend that they use, and they would never want to meet another person that uses it. But they can still feel like they're part of something bigger than their own experience with it by seeing how other people use it or eat it or cook with it online.
Great answer. That's a wrap. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. I'll see you soon this summer.
I'll see you soon.